Our world has become complex and disruptive, and leading teams and organizations takes courage, determination, and skill. This podcast connects you to some of the great leaders to find out just how they do it. You're listening to Russell Boyce and Daryl Crook in conversation with standout leadership in a world of disruption.
Welcome, listeners, welcome, friends and colleagues around the world to this next episode in Leadership in a Disruptive World. I'm Russell Boyce. I get to be the host tonight, just me, because I have the absolute pleasure of having a conversation about leadership in a disruptive world with Daryl. A couple of words of introduction. Daryl would call himself a management consultant. Daryl is actually a deep expert in the way that leaders and managers and organizations think and behave. He's been doing this for a long, long time. He's been doing it in areas of government, private ventures, not-for-profits, academic institutions. He's seen many success stories, many train smashes, and he's got an enormous amount of experience in the nuances and the not so nuanced challenges that come with trying to equip people to be the best leaders that they can be and to lead leadership in organizations through change and in dealing with challenges. I'm really, really looking forward to this next collection of conversation with Daryl as we tease out the view from the perspective of the management consultant. Daryl, welcome.
Thanks, Russ. Great to be here, and it's kind of nice to be on the receiving end, I guess, for a while, and have an opportunity to reflect a little bit on some of my journey. So happy to be here. Thank you.
So let's hook into it. You mentioned your journey. Let's start with that. Tell us, Daryl Crook, his journey in a nutshell, including the context that you've performed that journey in, or you've lived that journey in.
Well, you know, it always reminds me of some of those wedding speeches where they stand up and they start by telling you where the person was born, and you think, oh dear, we're in for a long story here. But I'll pick it up somewhere around 35 years ago. I had been in a senior executive position myself, and I had been lecturing, doing both of those things at the same time. And a colleague of mine approached me and he said, how about we formalize this and start a company? So he and I actually started corporate planning and enterprise management, trading as CPM Consulting Group. And that was in 1990-91. I bought him out in 94 because his style and my style were clearly going to be quite different. We were still very close friends, but he was more of a backroom academic, and I wanted to take the business in different ways. So my darling wife and I have been directors of the company since 94, and over those last 30-odd years, we have owned and run a fairly successful international consulting firm. And it's been a terrific ride, Russell. I've personally worked in 14 countries around the world, traveled through many more, and I've seen a lot of the world, and I've seen a lot of organizations, as you said in the introduction, in private, in public sector, in the not-for-profit sector, and learned so much myself about organizations and where the skeletons are buried, and what sort of nonsense sometimes goes on as it masquerades for good leadership or good culture or good performance. I've also seen some excellent leadership and excellent culture and excellent performance. And spending time, most of my time, I guess, over the last decade or so has been very much with boards and with senior execs. We sold the business in 2018. I kept the company, sold the business. with a very, very naive view of retiring. And I tried that a couple of times and failed miserably. And so here we are in 2023, and I'm now just working for myself and thoroughly enjoying that, and just saying yes to those clients that I really do want to say yes to. So finding that elusive life balance.
You mentioned the word, well, you used the word nonsense, and you attached that to some leadership styles or some leaders who might be in positions of quite some influence and responsibility, but they're probably masquerading. So that suggests that you've accumulated an ability to spot where the bad is, or to see what bad looks like, and conversely, what good looks like. Do you want to tease that out a bit?
Yeah. Look, most of us start with great technical skills in one area or another. We go to great universities and colleges around the world, and we graduate with a wonderful undergraduate degree in whatever it may be. And that undergraduate degree, whether it's in education or accounting or engineering or the sciences or whatever it may be in, usually it's those technical skills that get us our job. And usually it's those technical skills that keep us our job. And somewhere along the line, we become pretty good at those technical skills, and somebody notices that and they say, gee, you're really good at that. We're going to put you into a management role or a leadership role. And that's usually where the slippery slope starts, Russ. You know, you're a great plumber, we'll make you a team leader. You're a terrific electrician, we'll make you a supervisor. You're a wonderful accountant, we'll make you the finance manager. And Russell, even in your illustrious career in academia, you know, you're a terrific researcher, let's say, we'll make you head of school or head of discipline or something of that nature. We do it in every sector, in every industry. And it gets a little deeper than that, because they say, well, we're going to put you into a management role. And management differs enormously from leadership. It's interesting, I guess, how many folks have never really considered the difference, but gee, they're a mile apart in so many areas. You know, management's fundamentally about control, not in a bad way, but in a good way, because you've got to control costs and you've got to control quality. And you've got to control record keeping and information flow and all of your compliance areas. And you've got to control people. It's called rosters or scheduling or whatever it might be. But gee, that's not leadership. You know, sitting in front of several computer screens with spreadsheets everywhere and filling out reports and doing lots of graphs and charts and presenting those, that's management style. It's absolutely critical. Try running a business without management competencies, but let's not pretend it's leadership. At that point, these folks, their comfort zone is usually still back in the technical area. So they keep kind of gravitating back to their technical skills. And because that's, as I say, that's their comfort zone. That's where their ego was. That's where they became known. That's where they became a hero. That's what actually got them promoted. So they'll run back to those technical skills every chance they get, which is why most management consultants will refer to managers, perhaps not unkindly, as promoted technicians. And we really haven't sort of touched the leadership journey. The leadership journey extends beyond that. If you look at the difference, leadership's more about people and strategy in a broad sense. You know, where's the evidence that you can recruit and develop people well and build teams? And where's the evidence that you can coach and develop people and manage performance and manage conflict and have difficult conversations And where's the evidence that you really deeply understand relationship management in all of its forms? And then, of course, don't get me started on emotional intelligence, and we'll probably have a conversation about that today. And the second broad area of leadership, of course, is strategy, thinking strategically and acting strategically, and being able to get that big picture and bring your people with you. There's one thing having a vision, but it's not much good having a vision if you can't bring anyone with you. And conversely, it's no point bringing everybody on a journey if you really don't know where you're going. So I see people who are promoted technicians. I see people who are at best managers. And then occasionally you see really good leaders who are also good managers. Of course, you can be both. That's the idea. But they're certainly not one and the same.
So that begs the question then, is it possible to turn a manager into a leader? The listeners have probably heard the concept of striving to be the best leader that you can be, which suggests perhaps there's a limit to any individual person's capacity to be a good leader, or maybe that's not true. Wondering about your observations, your experience of that in dealing with so many leaders at all levels.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking as you were asking that question, Russell, that the only time this varies a little bit around different parts of the world, but as a broad statement, the only time we typically use the word leader is as a frontline leader, a team leader. After that, we start using the word manager all the time, you know, group manager, general manager, operations manager, sales manager, and the list goes on, right? And it's kind of funny that we only use the word leader very sparingly. Look, management competencies can be fairly easily taught. And for a number of years, I lectured MBA classes at a university. And you know, you can teach finance competencies and so forth. And you can teach a lot of the data analytics competencies that are required. And you can teach people how to read policies and put processes and systems in place. Those more functional things can easily be taught to just about anybody. Leadership's a bit different. And for decades, people have talked about the so-called nature-nurture debate. Are leaders made or born? And there's been much written about that. And I think for most researchers these days, they're pretty comfortable saying, look, it's a combination of both. And in saying that, there are some personality types that, or some personality traits, let's call it, that do find the leadership journey a lot more comfortable to take than others. So certainly there is to an extent, a genetic predisposition. But for the main part, that leadership journey is a journey of discovery, a journey of learning, a journey of self-awareness. You certainly can go to some great universities and pick up all of the areas, the functional areas of strategic thinking and planning and strategic execution. You can pick up all of the functional areas of how to manage a conflict, how to give feedback correctly, and so forth. But there's a naturalness for some people where they enjoy the journey and it shows. Others, it's a hard, rocky, stumbling, uncomfortable journey because it's just not their natural style to take on those things. They would probably far prefer to be working with technology or working with computers or working with things. And they're very good at that. There's no problem with that. They're very, very good at it. But to ask them to start to demonstrate some of the competencies of leadership, for some folks, it requires an enormous amount of discipline and hard work, whereas for others, it's an easier journey.
So wonder if you could give the listeners a little bit of insight into what's involved in walking in your shoes, not in the shoes of the leader grappling with leadership issues, but in your shoes as the consultant, getting alongside them, coaching them, mentoring them, having the hard conversation with them, potentially dragging them along, kicking and screaming. What's that like for you and folks in your industry?
Typically, my initial contact with an organization, so my initial client, would be either the chairman of the board or the CEO or the HR director. It's usually one of those three people who are going to make contact with me and ask me to come in. As a management consultant, as a consultant psych, I don't have a job description. I have more capability. You know, where would you like to use that capability? And for sometimes they'll call me in and they'll say, Darryl, can you help us with strategic planning for our organization over the next 3 months, 6 months, something like that? Sometimes it will be, Darryl, can you conduct an organizational review, a culture review, if you will, and have a really deep dive into our culture and what's working and what's not, and can you deliver that to the board in a couple of months' time? So those consulting engagements are certainly part of the capability. The part that you were alluding to, I guess, is around that executive coaching, when they will say to me, Darryl, can you sit with this particular executive, or can you sit with me, says the CEO. And at any given time, I'm probably coaching anything up to 15 or 18 or 20 senior executives around Australia and overseas. And so often it'll be the CEO who might say, can you come and sit next to me? You know, and I'd like monthly sessions with you. That's not unusual these days. It's actually unusual to find a CEO who sits there and says, I'm fine, I know it all. Most contemporary CEOs will say, look, I'm very good at my technical skills and I'm very good at financial management and I'm very good at some operational stuff, but I really need someone to sit with me and help me with this leadership journey. That's a lot easier when they call you in, rather than a board chairman saying to me, Darryl, you know, we're considering exiting our CEO. Would you sit with him or her for the next 3 or 6 months and give us your opinion on whether we're wasting our time or whether there is hope? So for those folks who are perhaps reluctant coachees, That's always interesting, and we often will, in due course, have some fairly candid conversations where they really do need to have a hard look at themselves, and they do need to perhaps answer some of the tougher questions, you know, in their own minds about their capability and about, I guess, the reality of their performance. But for the most part, Russell, by and large, working with senior executives is an absolute pleasure. They're wonderful people who realize that they need some support around varying areas of leadership. And that also will include a lot around their own personal lives. The stress of sometimes being a single parent, the stress of having to travel a lot and leaving family on a regular basis. The stress of dealing with a very difficult board of directors, the stress of having to completely restructure their business and let people go, and having sleepless nights around that. So the coaching engagement can be across a multitude of topics, depending on their needs and where they're at.
Pretty scary thing to take on a coach. Because you have to make yourself vulnerable if you're going to have any authentic experience at all. And as you said, most senior people have the insight and the self-awareness to get that. But still, to step out in faith and take on that coach and start exposing yourself, that's a scary thing. And I'm also thinking about the disruptive times that we're in. And so I want to ask you a two-part question. What's your advice to leaders who would be in the position where they're being offered a coach, or they've already got a coach, they're not quite sure how to make the most of that or how they should behave? You know, what's their part of the deal, if you like? And when it comes to it, to those disruptive times where just everything is going wrong, the challenges are there confronting the organization, you know, potentially the organization is facing an existential threat, and the coach hopefully is right there alongside that leader. How should that leader embrace the coach and make the most of the coach in that situation? Because it's so much opportunity, but you know, when the chips are down, everything's busy, they could just say, oh, I've got no need for the coach, I just got to get this problem solved. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a multi-pronged sort of a question.
Of course.
We can all look good in the good times, Russ. Yeah. You know, anyone can look good in the good times. When you're making money, or when you're performing in whatever it is, or when your government department is just going well and they're flush with cash, anyone can look good in the good times. But true leadership is what you look like when you're under pressure. Put anything under pressure to see what it really looks like, whether it's a piece of machinery or a piece of technology or a person. And it's interesting, you say, sometimes you'll get some senior executives who have an attitude of, you know, I'm fine, I know it all, I don't need anybody. And you watch them, and either they're floating along in the good times, and so they're perhaps living in a little bit of a fool's paradise, you know, I'm fine, look at the scoreboard. For other times, it really is sort of arrogance that they actually believe that they are, you know, absolutely perfect in every way. The better leaders will engage a coach in the long haul, through the good times and the bad, at the top of the cycle and at the bottom of the cycle of that business. And so they will have a regular relationship with an executive coach over quite a few years. There's a number of senior executives I've been working with now for I think in the longest situation, 20 years, and I'm still working with those couple of people, and they've gone from being middle managers all the way through now to being senior partners and board members themselves and so forth as they go on their journey to have someone with you. The key to all of this is relationships and trust. The start at the very beginning part of your question was around, I paraphrase, maybe selecting a coach and starting out. I strongly advise a company to suggest having several coaches that they perhaps are comfortable with and they put to a senior exec. And that senior exec can meet with those three, four different coaches and decide which of those people he or she would be most comfortable working with. Is the chemistry right? Do I feel that I can open up with this person? Are they going to be too easy on me and I won't grow? Are they going to be too hard and too fast on me and I will, you know, I'll sort of dissolve? So finding someone who can nudge you in the most loving of ways, someone who can put a firm hand on your shoulder and look firmly into your eyes when you need to, but is always supportive and respectful and caring of you and your needs all the way through. And for different people, that's different coaches and different coaching styles. So to be able to select a coach, to be able to be clear then around what is it that I need from that coach? Is it around a particular area? You know, I need to develop more competencies around governance, thinking and operations. I need to develop more competencies around relationship management, whatever it might happen to be. Let's be clear about that. Often I will, and most management consultants will start with some version of a battery of instruments, and whether that's a 360 or some behavioral instruments or perhaps some personality instruments combination, so that people can get that self-awareness and just start to go on that journey of discovery themselves. And if you can take a couple of those instruments around your behavioral styles or some of your personality traits and look at some of the areas that might need some development and areas where you've got some natural skills, and then to follow that up with, say, a 360 where you're getting feedback from your direct reports and colleagues and customers and, of course, your own manager. And often they will see that the feedback they were getting around their behavioral instruments is reflected in the feedback that observers give them, because you're starting to answer the question in a 360, how do other people experience me? If they can take that journey, the journey of self-realization, gee, there it is, I do need to work on that, that's a lot easier than someone like me sitting there trying to convince them that, in my view, they need to work on it. I prefer, much prefer, they discover that for themselves.
I was going to ask the very simple question, how do you spot a bad coach? But let me nuance it a little bit. Is it possible that there are coaches out there that look good on paper and are confident and come across like they're the real deal, but there's deficiencies in their skills or their qualifications or their own emotional intelligence that means they could lead you into poor outcomes, even dangerous outcomes? How do you, are there any telltale warning signs that you've come across that leaders might be able to use to get their alarm bells?
One of the beautiful things about these podcasts, I guess, Russell, is, you know, I can give a view on things, and people out there listening around the world can make their own decision whether they agree or disagree with my opinion. And I'll put a little qualification there. This is my opinion. It's only based on 35 years of work globally, plus a couple of qualifications along the way, I guess. I would be wary of someone who did a one-weekend certificate in learning to be a coach in a weekend. And those type of things do exist out there. I'd be very wary of someone who's done a two-day course or a one-week course or something like that, for a start. I'd be very wary of someone who has a bit of the old, drop and give me 10 style, reminiscent of old sporting coaches of decades ago, or the I'll scream at you through a megaphone and make you run a mile and I'll call myself a coach. I don't think that's appropriate. And so, in an ideal world, that person is going to have qualifications in business and psychology in an ideal world, and preferably at graduate level. In an ideal world, they're going to have the people skills themselves, of course. They're going to practice what they preach. They're going to demonstrate what good leadership is. They're going to demonstrate what good emotional intelligence is. They're going to be able to not just use the buzzwords, but there's a chemistry and a character about them that is genuine. Getting feedback from other people, other companies is absolutely critical. I've had the very good fortune of running that international consulting company for 30 years with zero marketing and zero advertising. It was 100% word of mouth. And I think for anybody, that would be a dream run, where you're not marketing yourself, you're not advertising yourself. People are contacting you and saying you've been strongly recommended to us. So I think that kind of proof in the pudding type of thing, where other companies, other executives, and they do meet, and they meet regularly at conferences, and most of them know each other because they move around from one company to another across varying sectors. And quite often, as they move from, and this has happened to me on numerous occasions, they'll move from one company to another company, and of course they'll take their coaches with them. So it's very much the relationship-based recommendations and the evidence-based recommendations, you know, where they will say, can you recommend someone to me who actually gets results, who actually is a good, well-qualified, well-experienced coach, rather than perhaps having a quick look online and with people with their slick advertising. So those sorts of things, I guess, in my experience, certainly have been important.
Let's switch gears. Let's talk about boards and senior executive teams where somebody like you might be called in to perform a review, because things haven't been going quite as they should, or maybe there's a lurking problem that's surfaced. So I'd like to give some quick insight into the sorts of the patterns that you've observed over the years that keep coming up in boards or senior executive teams that lead to the need for such a review. And then I've got a follow-up question after that, but I won't bamboozle you with a multi-pronged one.
Keep your powder dry on that one, Russell. Okay. So let me. We've talked a bit about senior executives, and I guess I would round out the issue with senior executives with this comment, or with two or three comments quickly, and then we'll get to boards. You know, I performance, generally speaking, at a very broad level, is a combination of our IQ. You know, how much smarts have we got going on upstairs, and how much firepower have we got going on upstairs, plus our qualifications. What have we got hanging on the wall, and that includes also informal qualifications. You know, what reading do we do, and what conferences do we go to, and have we got a coach ourselves? You know, our informal qualifications, our experience, where have we worked, private, public, big, small, overseas, internationally, locally, where have we worked? Because that has an enormous impact on our view of the world. And then, of course, our emotional intelligence. Traditionally, people hired around IQ plus qualifications plus experience. More contemporary professional recruiters know that the IQ and the qualifications and the experience are usually pretty constant among executives. They don't vary all that much. It's the emotional intelligence that is the huge area that varies. And funny enough, it's the emotional intelligence, the last part of that formula, if you like, where they will derail. People don't derail around their IQ. They don't derail around qualifications, and they don't derail around their experience. And senior execs have plenty of all three of those. They derail around emotional intelligence. And so spending a fair amount of the time developing that for those senior execs. When we have a look at boards, what do I notice? Now, as an Australian, a lot of the boards, the majority of the boards I work with are Australian boards. And as a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, I'm often called on, as they often will do, they'll contact fellows of AICD to help with board reviews or some board training or to help give some presentations to the boards to help them develop and so forth. What do I notice? A couple of things. Australian boards, if you read the OECD literature, you'll see that Australian boards usually score very, very well compared to a lot of boards in other countries around the world. And that's partly because of the regulations that have been put around boards these days through the Corporations Act and so forth. And so we do see Australian boards scoring fairly well on OECD kind of standards. but we still see the same problems coming up time and time again. A network of friends. Now, on one hand, having a network of friends as a board, yes, they know each other and they get on well. But if the only qualification is that you're good friends and buddies and mates and you like to have a drink together, I hardly think that's qualifications to sit on a board. Getting diversity is critical on boards, and we don't see that diversity. We see a lot of people coming out of the same sector sitting on a board. Well, that's not diversity of background or qualifications or technical experience terribly well. They're all from the same sector and they all speak the same language and they all view things the same way. So I'm a great advocate for diversity, diversity of age, diversity of qualifications, diversity of culture, of course, diversity of gender, that goes without saying, diversity of thinking styles. But for most folks, they find that diversity brings conflict. We become very wary of people who are not like us. So, but if we can get past our fear of difference and embrace that diversity, we can find that it will bring better decision making, which is what boards are paid to do, make decisions. So I see a lot of them still struggling around that diversity factor and all of the areas of diversity. I see advisory boards often acting as a governance board. And if they're appointed as an advisory board, that's fine. And that's a support for the senior executives. It's a support for the CEO. They can give their opinion and suggestions on things. They can challenge things, but they really can't necessarily direct or control the CEO. And of course, boards typically around the world will have one employee only, the CEO. So if you're on an advisory board, that's fine, that's terrific, but don't start acting as a governance board and start directing and making all of the decisions and controlling. You actually have not a right to do that. So we do see creep happening there. What else do we see? The classic one that I will see is where boards get too operational. This is just everywhere. There's a couple of reasons as to why they will get too operational. One, they haven't been well trained. And perhaps they were a senior executive once and they were very operationally focused, and then they go onto a board and they forget to change their hats. They're still wearing the hat of a senior executive and thinking like one. So they get too operational because they really haven't switched hats and they're now a board member. The second problem why they get too operational sometimes is around trust. They just don't trust the CEO or they don't trust the executive. They feel as though something's being hidden from them or they're not getting the full picture. So they start delving all into the operational stuff and getting way into the detail. And we uncover it as a trust issue, which is a different remedy than simply an education issue. And the third reason often they get into this micromanagement, funny enough, is they're just really interested. And they're enormously interested in what the company is doing. And for many of them, they were a boss themselves in that sector or in that company even. And they keep asking more and more detailed questions because they're interested. And that's where the rot sets in, because the CEO and the senior executive start to feel that they're being micromanaged, that the board's trying to do their job for them. And then you get this tension between the senior executives and the board members, where there should be a harmonious cooperation and respect. And at that point, everything starts to sort of go south. So I still do see a lot of that. Probably the last pattern that I see in, two more patterns that I see in boards is they'll go and try to get their technical diversity. Yes, we've got someone in finance, we've got a professional in marketing, we've got a professional in organizational development and You know, we've got a professional in the legal profession, and look at us. Look at the diversity we've got. We've got someone from every profession sitting on our board. But when you look closely at the research on functioning, well-functioning boards, it's not so much that, it's the relationships. Do they trust each other? Are they cohesive? Do they respect each other? Do they play well together? And we find that they struggle around that. Final comment on boards, particularly when you look at the not-for-profit boards, but not only. You ask yourself, why do they go on the board in the first place? And I guess I've discovered there's three broad reasons that they will go onto it, particularly for not-for-profits, even all the way through to a school board or even a parents and citizens board or a parents and friends board, a sort of committee type of thing, the committee structure. There's three reasons. One, ego. Look at me, look at me, look at me, I'm chairman of the board, look at me, I'm very important, and it's all about me, you know? And they swagger around telling everybody, oh, look, I get a front row seat at this and I get invited to that because I'm on the board. That's about ego. The second reason I see people go on is personal agenda. They go onto the board because they want to get a particular project up and running, or they have a particular personal agenda about getting something done or fixed or changed. And that's not going to end well. And then the third reason, the right reason I would put, is they go on there with genuine intent. Can I help? I'd love to be able to help, to be part of this, and that positive intention. Usually you can see whether they're there for ego or personal agenda or genuine intentions. So relationships are critical. Diversity is critical. Stay away from the micromanagement for the reasons that we talked about, and be very clear about your reason for being on that board and hold yourselves accountable for that. They're probably the main patterns that I tend to see, Russ.
So I promised you that we were in the middle of a multi-pronged question. Here comes the second part, and it'll be the last question. You've done a review of the board, probably at the request of the chairman of the board, and there are serious problems that need to be addressed. So you've got the data, the board's got the data, you've proposed a way to execute, but then how do you actually achieve the hard task, the human task, of putting that into action? Because it can be a very delicate, traumatic experience, especially if the problem turns out to be the chairman or chairwoman of the board themselves. Any insights into that challenge before we wind up this very interesting podcast?
Well, you thoroughly asked the most difficult question of all. And, you know, quite often, if I've done, let's say, an organizational review, which normally can take sort of weeks and sometimes months to do an organizational review, and you present the report, you know, who are you presenting the report to? And sometimes if that report shows a failure of leadership, then the leadership team is not going to take the report terribly well, because they get all defensive and upset and aggressive, and they become quite adversarial. I probably get struck off their Christmas card list. Similarly, if I do a board review and the problem happens to be an incompetent chair, let's say, or a whole incompetence of the board, it's a little easier, because you can sit down and you can work with them and say, it's really difficult sitting on a board. And every one of us, we come along with good intent. But so, like I was saying before, but sometimes I've noticed, and certainly the feedback from the staff is that you folks are way too much into the detail, and you're trying to run the company as a board member where you shouldn't be doing that. That's probably because you're just really, really interested, and you've probably got to the top of the operations yourself in your career. So I kind of appeal to them without sort of hitting them terribly hard. If it's the chairman of the board, I will often appeal to her or appeal to him to be able to say, you know, it's very, very difficult. being able to keep order as a chair when you've got a lot of quite dominant people around the table, and it's taking its toll on you, and people are starting to give that feedback. How about we take this offline, and I can give you some tips and tricks of perhaps that might help you to do that. So the term I often will use, Russell, is that pragmatic empathy, or sometimes referred to as empathic pragmatism. That empathy is clearly there. You know, I get it. I understand it's difficult. And I understand being on a board is difficult, and the obligation and the commitment that you have to make is very challenging. However, look at the impact it's having. Let's work together to see what we can do around this. Usually I can work my way through. If we had a lot longer on this podcast, I could tell you some horror stories as well, Russell.
Darryl, last comment from you. One word of advice from a very experienced management consultant to current and future leaders in a disruptive world, what would that word be?
What got you here won't get you there. Your technical skills got you here, fantastic. Start working on your leadership skills as young as you can. Work on your emotional intelligence, work on your people skills, because you will derail sooner or later if you haven't got that area right.
Darryl Crook, thank you so much. Listeners, thank you for joining us for this insight into the world of a management consultant. And thanks also to Prue, our wonderful producer. Thank you.
Thanks, Russ. It's been a pleasure.